When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Good evening, everyone. We have a lot of news to get to tonight, including the increasingly bizarre story of Trump's favorite little congressman, Matt Gaetz, who's under investigation for possible sex trafficking. We'll break down what we know and what Gaetz is claiming. But we begin the readout tonight with day three of the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. George Floyd's life mattered. That was the emotional crux of today's testimony, a day that offered something we haven't seen very much of since George Floyd died under Chauvin's knee almost a year ago. Today, we got to see George Floyd alive. Here's surveillance video inside Cup Foods, where he'd shopped just before being stopped by police. Footage that was unseen by the public before today. You can see George Floyd in a black tank top dancing around. You can also see him interacting with customers and cashiers. One of those cashiers testified today. His name is Christopher Martin, and he's 19 years old. Floyd bought cigarettes from him the day that he died, giving him a $20 bill. And Martin testified today that he was suspicious. But because of a store policy that made employees pay for counterfeit bills out of their own paycheck, Martin reported it to his manager. A decision that set off a chain of events that would end with Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. The violent, brutal death of George Floyd and the national outrage over his killing that reverberated far beyond Minneapolis has undoubtedly traumatized the Floyd family and their loved ones. But what we're seeing up close this week is the trauma experienced by those who happened to witness the final chapter of his life. To be clear, they are not at fault. They were powerless in the face of armed police officers to even intervene. They're people who happened to be on that exact street corner on the day that George Floyd was handcuffed and pinned to the ground. Either they happened to work at Cup Foods or, like Charles McMillan, they happened to be driving by when police first tried to put Floyd in the back of that car. He saw the struggle unfold, tried to advise Floyd to cooperate, telling Floyd, "You can't win." And then today on the witness stand, Mr. McMillan relived the incident again after watching prosecutors play body cam video of George Floyd's death.
Oh my God. I can feel helpless. I don't have a mama either, and I understand him.
Wow. Joining me now is Shauna Lloyd, a criminal and civil rights attorney and managing partner at the Cochran Firm, and Cedric Alexander, former member of President Barack Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing and former director of public safety for DeKalb County, Georgia. Mr. Alexander, I want to go to you on this first because, you know, we are so accustomed, at least in this business, unfortunately, I have covered a lot of Black Lives Matter cases, and there's a lot of grief. There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of strain. The George Floyd case has allowed us to really see the strain of witnesses very much up close. So many people witnessed this man die or were near him just before he died that now we're sort of experiencing their trauma. Let me play a quick little montage of some of these witnesses who've actually expressed guilt. And they played no part in his death, but expressed guilt regarding his death. Take a listen.
What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief. And guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
There was no medical assistance on scene, and I got there, and I could have given medical assistance. That's exactly what I should have done.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more. And not physically interacting and not saving his life.
Yeah, as an experienced public safety director yourself, is that something that you're familiar with seeing, that kind of trauma and sort of guilty feelings by people who witness a killing?
Well, I'm familiar with it on two counts here, Joy. One, being a 40-year veteran in policing, and certainly have seen these types of events, but nothing to what we witness today, we'll continue to witness. This is horrific. It's just absolutely a horrific event. It's embarrassing for the law enforcement profession. It is not reflective, certain of all the men and women out there, but what we saw from the beginning of their interaction with George Floyd was just wrong. And quite frankly, if you even think about the fact that this may have been a counterfeit $20 bill,
yeah,
it really didn't have to go into an arrest. But the second piece here, as a former practicing clinical psychologist, we're seeing people who are tremendously traumatized each day in court, but not only on the streets of Minneapolis and their families, but across this country, people are traumatized and people are really feeling really heartfelt about what they're seeing every day. This is horrible.
Indeed. You know, and Shauna, you know, this is sort of an experience I think everybody has experienced in all these Black Lives Matter cases. I mean, Tamir Rice, that could be our baby. You know, you see, you know, Trayvon Martin, that beautiful face. You think you relate because you relate to them. Isn't the challenge here that the one person who couldn't seem to relate to George Floyd's humanity, well, the four people, are these officers, right? I mean, meanwhile, a juror today halted the trial because the juror had a stress-related reaction. This is a white woman in her 50s, suffered what the judge called a stress-related reaction. She's been having trouble sleeping and had been awake since 2 a.m. And isn't that kind of the crux of the case, right? The four people who needed to see George's humanity didn't.
I definitely think that that is a very significant, impactful point. And I think the prosecution is layering that in by having each one of these bystanders that had such a different experience, different training, different background. Still, each one of them had a visceral reaction to what was happening. They all came to one general body and consensus of thought that this is unacceptable. And that's significant. And that is going, that's not going to be lost on our jury.
Yeah. And you can hear Mr. McMillan begging him, you know, just cooperate, just cooperate. You can't win. You can hear it. And it's so striking. Let's go through and talk about this fake bill piece of it, Mr. Alexander, because this is part of the crux of the prosecution case. Well, he tried to pass a fake $20 bill. You know, Michael Eric Dyson sent me a piece from his book, a book that he wrote earlier, which he talked about the fact that, you know, there wasn't even a real strong belief that it was really a counterfeit 20. Here's Christopher Martin talking about whether or not he knew that the bill was fake.
The other person that had come in, it kind of seemed like he was trying to scheme, like he knew it was a fake bill and he was trying to get over. I thought that George didn't really know that it was a fake bill, so I thought I'd be doing him a favor.
So, I mean, if that is the crux of the case, that he had committed this horrible crime trying to pass a fake bill, that's not even clear.
No, it's not clear. And here again, we're not certain whether it was really a fake bill. But let's say it was a real bill, just for the sake of conversation here, Joy. The reality of it is, it did not need to escalate to that point. It is a phony, potentially phony $20 bill.
Yeah.
That's it. That could have been an arrest ticket at minimum. You give him an arrest ticket and send him on this way. For them to go through what they did to over a phony, possibly for only $20 bill, should not have led up to what it led up to on May 25th of 2020.
Let me play some more of Christopher Martin. He was very compelling in that he's so young and he lived above the Cut Foods store. And he said he doesn't even live there anymore. I mean, like people are saying they didn't want to go in the store anymore. That's how traumatized they were. Here's a little bit more of his testimony.
Can you describe for the jurors, you know, generally what his demeanor was like? What was his condition like?
So when I had asked him if he played baseball, he went on to respond to that, but it kind of took him a little long to get to what he was trying to say. So it would appear that he was high.
So you just had some signs that you thought he was under the influence of something?
Yes.
All right. But were you able to carry on at least some conversation with him?
Yes.
Is this a portent of bad things to come, Shauna, that the defense is going to try to make George Floyd look like he was sort of out of his mind and high? But that's not what this young man said. He interacted with him.
I think that the defense overpromised a bit here. I think that when you see this video, what they described, the intensity with which the police department responded, were going to give you a sense of something very different. And this video shows a very calm, laid back. He was dancing a jig. He hugs someone. It's the antithesis of what they built this up to be. And that is going to be something that the jury is going to hold on to, because you cannot overpromise and undeliver. And that's what this did.
Well, and also they're going to try to make it look like he was sort of on the verge of death anyway. He sure didn't look like it. As you said, he's dancing around. He's responding to people. He looked happy, looked jolly. He looked friendly. It's going to be a hard time to convince people he was some sort of, you know, a monster that was zonked out on drugs. That doesn't look like it, at least from what people who interacted with him said. Let's play one more piece. This is actually kind of chilling. This is an interaction between Derek Chauvin, who was then a police officer, and a bystander who confronted him after this whole confrontation ended. Take a look.
We gotta control this guy because he's a sizable guy.
Yeah, and I thought he didn't get in the car.
He's probably on something.
Does that wash as an explanation, Cedric Alexander, that he's like, well, we got to control him? I mean, he didn't seem too pressed about what he'd done.
Well, first of all, if we look at that video, we will see there was at no point, to be honest with you, that George Floyd was really ever violent towards those police officers. Was he resisting to get into the back of the car because he felt paranoid? He felt some sense of being enclosed? To be perfectly honest with you, that's statement around, well, he was a big guy. Well, there's four police officers there, and they've had more than enough officer need to contain him. And when they held him down to the ground the way that they did, and Chauvin put his knee in his neck, is just beyond anything that is imaginable. But when you think about that video on that day and what we're watching every day, we're seeing an officer who demonstrates no sense of humanity, no sense of care for people who live in that community, even the people who are saying to him, please, officer, let him breathe. This man was totally disconnected emotionally from any reality and should have never been in that police department whatsoever. And those other three officers, they're just as culpable in all of this.
Yeah, the coldness of those officers and their attitude. You see Officer Tao just standing there like they didn't seem to care at all that this man was dying. Versus the emotion, the deep emotion we're seeing coming from these witnesses, the people who are weeping, the trauma that you're seeing. It's quite a divergence there. Shauna Lloyd, Cedric Alexander, thank you both. Really appreciate you both. And up next on The Readout, the plot thickens. Congressman Matt Gaetz under investigation for possible sex trafficking. He denies it and says he's the victim of an extortion plot. Trump's self-appointed mini-me is not charged with anything, so he is spared the dubious honor of being tonight's absolute worst. That goes to one of his colleagues in the Q caucus, whose hypocrisy is so brazen, you literally have to see it to believe it. The big reveal is coming up. Plus, President Biden's Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo joins me on the real, honest-to-goodness arrival of Infrastructure Week after 4 years of fake Infrastructure Weeks. The readout continues after this. We are following the ongoing and, frankly, truly bizarre story of Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz. Following the revelation by the New York Times that he's under federal investigation for a possible sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl. Specifically, the Justice Department is probing whether Gaetz violated federal sex trafficking laws by paying for her to travel with him. Gaetz has denied involvement with underage girls and told Axios, quote, I believe that there are people at the Department of Justice who are trying to criminalize my sexual conduct, you know, when I was a single guy. But notably, the investigation of Gaetz was opened during the Trump administration under Attorney General William Barr. And despite Barr's history of political interference in federal investigations involving friends and allies of the former guy, Politico reports that Barr was briefed on the Gaetz probe and did not take issue with it. While denying the conduct under investigation, Gaetz has claimed that he is actually the victim of an elaborate extortion attempt. And he revealed the existence of another investigation into the plot that he's alleging.
What is happening is an extortion of me and my family involving a former Department of Justice official. On March 16th, my father got a text message demanding a meeting wherein a person demanded $25 million in exchange for making horrible sex trafficking allegations against me go away. His name is David McGee.
Well, David McGee, who was a federal prosecutor 25 years ago, denied any attempt to extort Gates, telling the Daily Beast that this is a blatant attempt to distract from the fact that Matt Gates is apparently about to be indicted for sex trafficking underage girls. NBC News confirmed today that two separate investigations are ongoing, one into Gates for possible sex trafficking and one into the extortion plot that he has alleged. The investigation into Gates began when his associate, Joel Greenberg, was indicted on multiple charges last year, including a count of sex trafficking of a child. Greenberg pleaded not guilty to the charges. Photos from Greenberg's social media feed show him with Gates on two occasions, including one with Roger Stone in 2017. And while Gates has been quick to allege extortion, he's offered few details about why he would be the subject of a sex trafficking probe. He even seemed to confuse Tucker Carlson in the process of explaining it.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
What is the allegation? That's really not very clear from these news stories.
Yeah, again, I only know what I've read in the New York Times. I can say that actually you and I went to dinner about 2 years ago. Your wife was there and I brought a friend of mine. You'll remember her. And she was actually threatened by the FBI, told that if she wouldn't cop to the fact that somehow I was involved in some pay-for-play scheme, that she could face trouble.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly.
He always has that look on his face, but this time it's like we kind of understand why Tucker Carlson had that look on his face. With me now, Michael Schmidt, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, who broke this story last night, and former U.S. Attorney Joyce Vance. Michael, I not to have you comment on another paper's reporting, but there does seem to be an advance to this story. I want to know what you have on this angle. The Washington Post is reporting tonight on this alleged extortion plot that reportedly Gates was approached by two men, or not Gates, his father reportedly was approached by two men, people familiar with the matter said, who had no apparent connection to the sex crimes investigation of Congressman Gates, other than having somehow learned about the investigation somehow before it was publicly reported, and essentially offered if he would give them a bunch of money to try to locate Robert A. Levinson, the longest held American hostage in Iran. If the operation was a success, it would somehow win favor with the U.S. government and alleviate Gates' legal woes. That is a weird, convoluted thing. I'm not sure it even sounds like extortion. Do you have any information on that?
So yesterday, as we were preparing to publish our story, we spoke to Gates on the phone, and he laid out for us this scheme that he said has been cooked up against him. I found it difficult to follow and understand. It's my understanding that the U.S. government has concluded that Robert Levinson has been dead for several years. He had gone missing in Iran on an apparent CIA mission, but that Levinson, the government believes he's dead. And so I'm not sure how all of this fits together. Gates has effectively used it as a distraction, from the underlying investigation. And in many ways, such an investigation would be an existential threat to a politician's career. So in some ways, it's not surprising.
Did he explain to you why, in his view, he would even be subject to an extortion plot? Because if somebody is saying they're extorting you because you're being investigated for sex trafficking and sex trafficking of a minor, did he add that second piece as to why he thinks somebody would think they could get $25 million to extort him over that?
Well, I think the notion would be that these people could make the investigation go away. I think would be if we're trying to understand the logic of the scheme that has been laid out. Getting the Justice Department to move away from anything, seems like a very, very difficult thing to do. I'm sure Joyce can speak to that, how far-fetched that notion is. I wish I could make better sense of the scheme so people could understand this story better. But I've struggled with it myself.
Joyce, can you just answer that question? Is this the way the Justice Department typically works, that if you can provide information on a missing person in Iran, and you didn't even do it yourself, basically saying these two men, whoever they are, if he could somehow give $25 million, the dad would, then somehow it would make Gates look good to who? I mean, this was the Trump administration. This wasn't even, I don't get it. Is this the way the Justice Department works?
None of us get this. I mean, this is the difficulty in discussing this story. Literally nothing about it makes sense right now. But obviously, to Mike's point, and as you know, Joy, you can't pay $25 million to make an investigation against you go away. And this is a little bit more near and dear to the heart of most prosecutors, because if there's any kind of investigation prosecutors take deadly seriously, it's these investigations into sex trafficking of minors. The prosecutors who do these cases tends to be one or two people in each district. They're very focused. They're very networked across the country. They're very committed to doing these cases and getting the longest sentences possible so these folks can't hurt children anymore. The notion that you could pay $25 million to make a child sex trafficking case go away is just ludicrous. Even in Bill Barr's Justice Department, that wouldn't have worked.
Let's talk about Bill Barr's Justice Department for a moment, Michael, because one of the intriguing sort of things about this very weird case is the idea that it was opened under Bill Barr's Justice Department, which was very disfavorable toward investigations that could harm allies of the former president. In this case, it appears that Barr knew about it and was okay with it.
So when an elected official or someone of prominence comes under investigation, it has to be briefed to the Justice Department. At times, senior Justice Department officials have to sign off on it, given the sensitivities around it. And in this case, the Justice Department allowed the investigation to move forward. The alleged conduct was very troubling. Mm-hmm. And, there was certainly significant evidence there. And, they allowed the investigation to move forward. In normal times that would be significant, but because President Trump so politicized the Justice Department and talks so much about ongoing investigations and about how corrupt the Justice Department was and the FBI was, we're sitting here talking about the fact that it's notable that an investigation was allowed to go forward. And that just typically under another president wouldn't be the case.
Indeed. Yeah, the fact that that is even a question is actually a pretty negative statement about William Barr. Let me play another piece of this also very weird Tucker Carlson interview with Matt Gaetz. Here it is.
If you just saw our Matt Gaetz interview, that was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted. That story just appeared in the news a couple of hours ago. And on the certainty that there's always more than you read in the newspaper, we immediately called Matt Gaetz and asked him to come on and tell us more, which, as you saw, he did. I don't think that clarified much, but it certainly showed this is a deeply interesting story, and we'll be following it.
Well, and that is, of course, the post-interview. That was not during the interview. That was the post-interview. But, Joyce, it did clarify one thing. Matt Gaetz is determined to put Tucker Carlson at a table with whoever it is that the Justice Department is potentially investigating him over. Is Tucker Carlson potentially going to pop up on a witness list for this investigation?
you know, hard to say. That certainly seemed like it was what Matt Gaetz was trying to do in that really strange interview. The one thing that's clear, the only certain takeaway I have from this, is that the congressman needs a lawyer. He needs to have someone giving him legal advice because he is perilously close to incriminating himself, conceding some of the elements of potential crimes, and just running his mouth in a way that no one who's the subject of a federal investigation should be doing.
Yeah, and he might want to do better than his favorite president in terms of his choice of lawyers. Michael, where is this going? Because the big question I think that seems obvious is there an individual young woman in question, you know, an underage person in question that journalists like yourself are aware of? Is that a thing that you can report on or that you think will be revealed imminently in this very strange case?
I think it's going to take some time to really figure out where this is all headed. This investigation, as you pointed out, was an outgrowth of one into a local tax collector in a small in a county outside of Orlando, and it has grown into this. That tax collector is scheduled to go on trial this summer in June. He's been charged with an array of things. He was actually indicted again today on different charges unrelated to the trafficking issue. So there's obviously a lot of activity here that's going on. This investigation has been going on for some time, for many months, at least certainly on the tax collector. And, you know, we're just trying to follow every lead as much as we can.
And the last question to you, Joyce, in terms of the law, if somebody goes to someone and says, hey, you know, if you give me a lot of money, I might be able to come up with some information that'll make you look good to prosecutors. Is that actually extortion?
You know, extortion is more of a threat, threatening to disclose information or threatening violence against you is what triggers the federal extortion statute. This is more akin to some sort of an almost a pay-to-play scheme, which is interesting because Gaetz used that language in the interview with Tucker Carlson, sort of saying, if you pay me a lot of money, I can get public officials to act corruptly in your case. But again, the facts are so attenuated here. The individuals named aren't current DOJ officials. It's right. Just really tough to understand how this was supposed to work.
It is. It is really weird. And he revealed the father wearing a wire. It's all very strange. But thank you for helping us to try to understand it. Michael Schmidt, great reporting. And Joyce Vance, thank you very much. Okay, we've got a lot more to get to tonight. Ooh, weird. Including Joe Biden, super ambitious. $2 trillion infrastructure plan, and Florida Republicans still leading the way in demonstrating how not to deal with a pandemic. And of course, our absolute worst. Don't go anywhere. Congratulations, America. It's finally Infrastructure Week. You may be used to what happened every time the previous administration turned to the topic. During his first infrastructure week, the former president accused his former FBI director of lying. Later that year, he derailed an infrastructure event by blaming both sides for the violence in Charlottesville. And in 2019, he stormed out of an infrastructure meeting, blaming Democrats for investigating him. As the New York Times' Katie Rogers put it, Infrastructure Week was a Groundhog Day-style fever dream doomed to be repeated. But the curse is officially broken today. President Biden introduced the first part of an actual infrastructure plan, free of any other drama.
Today, I'm proposing a plan for the nation that rewards work, not just rewards wealth. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America. If we act now, in 50 years, people are going to look back and say, this was the moment that America won the future.
The $2.25 trillion bill, among many things, invests in transportation as well as safer drinking water, a modernized electric grid, broadband access, and affordable housing. President Biden plans to raise the money to pay for it by raising taxes on corporations. In a new poll from Politico and Morning Consult, a majority said they would support a Biden infrastructure plan. It's an investment America desperately needs. A recent report from the American Society of Civil Engineers gave America a C-. when it comes to our infrastructure needs. I'm joined now by Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo. Thank you so much for being here. So let's go through this bill. It's $2.25 trillion, $621 billion for transportation infrastructure. That means roads, bridges, electric vehicles, $400 billion to care for the elderly. You've got a lot of stuff. You can see it up there. Safer drinking water, revitalizing manufacturing, sustainable housing. Sounds really good. How do you actually get it through Congress?
Yeah. Good evening, Joy. It's great to be with you. We are optimistic that we will get it through Congress. You know, the president has been clear. There's room for compromise. Today begins the discussion and the debate. He has done what a great leader does, put forth his vision. And now we begin the discussion. But what I would say is we can't afford not to do it. I mean, this is about basic fairness. It's about rebuilding. It's about American competitiveness. It's investing in our workers, investing in businesses, basic research. As you were pointing out, we have deferred for too long. It's time to take action. And our grandkids are going to be grateful if we do it.
The last sort of big infrastructure president was Dwight David Eisenhower. It feels like we haven't repaired some of our roads and bridges since the Eisenhower administration. So it seems like something that typically Republicans and Democrats, you know, politics is about filling the potholes and, you know, building stuff. Like, that seems sort of bipartisan. But even with that, can you name one Republican who is in favor of this bill? And also, is Joe Manchin on board?
You know, again, today's the beginning. The president outlined the vision a couple of hours ago. I am optimistic that we will have Republican support for portions of the plan. For example, the area that I will work on a great deal is investments in the semiconductor industry. I know there is bipartisan support for that. Investments in broadband. It's a shame that not everyone in America has access to high-quality, affordable broadband. And there is bipartisan support for that. You know, by the way, that means everyone. If you live in a city or if you live on a tribal land or if you live in a rural area, and there are a lot, there is support for that across the aisle. So I am optimistic. I know it's not going to be easy. I know it's a challenging political environment. This is an American bill. It's about giving Americans the chance to compete, and it's about out-competing where we need to. It's about standing up for American workers and American businesses.
Let's talk about what you might have to trade. I mean, you have people on the left side. You have AOC and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now they're saying it's not big enough. You need to do more and invest more money. On the other side, you know, are you going to wind up having to trade, you know, adding coal and fossil fuel, you know, stuff in there in order to get people like your Joe Manchins to go along with it? Because, you know, at the end of the day, one of the things we're hearing that, you know, the proposal is to maybe roll back some of the salt tax, what they call the tax that used to save you money in blue states, where that was gone away, sort of rolling that back. I mean, what are you going to have to trade in order to create a coalition to pass this bill? Are you going to end up having to do stuff that's actually going to hurt the environment when this bill is supposed to actually be pro-environment?
Yeah. So, again, today is the beginning. And, of course, there will be compromise. The president has been very clear with us, his team. He wants to get something done, which means reaching out across the aisle and looking for common ground.
But I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but, you know, climate change is like a big deal. It's a big issue, and this bill is supposed to help address it. But would you be willing to trade things that would increase the amount of coal or the amount of oil that's being used? Because that's the kind of stuff that I can foresee, you know, Prince Joe Manchin coming in and demanding. Are you willing to do that? Or is the president going to do what he did on the stimulus and say, no, there's certain red lines here?
Yeah, look, this is a values-based package, and we are not going to compromise on core values. And meeting the challenges of climate change is a core value. Equity is a core value. But, you know, certainly I would not want to speak for my friend Senator Manchin, but there's a lot in this package that he would like, I think, and that's great for the people of West Virginia. It's about putting people back to work in West Virginia. It's about putting people to work in manufacturing. It's about training folks so they can be prepared to get the jobs of today and tomorrow. It's about housing in West Virginia and in every state in America. So there really is a lot to like. If you're serious about putting Americans back to work in good-paying jobs, you have to be for this. And yes, there'll be compromise, but not on the core values to the point that you're asking.
I guess the last question would be, will this perhaps, we'll pass on that for just a moment. Let me actually play you a little bit of the way that the first cabinet meeting for the former president went. This is we'll just end this sort of on a fun note. Here is the first cabinet meeting for the former president, because I know there's a first cabinet meeting for Joe Biden coming up. Take a look.
Mr. President, thank you for the honor to serve.
Thank you, Mr. President. It was a great honor traveling with you around the country for the last year, and an even greater honor to be here serving in your cabinet.
Mr. President, privileged to be here.
Greatest privilege of my life.
We thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people.
So tomorrow is the first cabinet meeting for President Biden. Have you scripted your effusive praises, or do you think that might not be required?
Well, I do love the president, and it is an honor to serve, but we're ready to get to work. We are ready to get to work. We're already working. And by the way, as I looked around that table, I hope you'll see tomorrow a much more diverse group of people around the president, and I'm very proud to serve under a president who values diversity and equity.
That will be a refreshing change. Secretary Gina Raimondo, thanks for taking some time, having some fun with us at the end. Before we take a quick break, a quick update on a story that we covered last night on the readout. Police in New York City have arrested a man they believe carried out that brutal assault on a 65-year-old Asian American woman on Monday. Police say the suspect, 38-year-old Brandon Elliott, was paroled in 2019. Get this, after serving 17 years for stabbing his mother to death. He's being charged with felony assault as a hate crime. We'll be right back.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
If you've received your much-needed economic relief check from the American Rescue Plan, that is great. You can thank the Biden administration, House and Senate Democrats, and frankly, the voters of Georgia, because, friendly reminder, zero Republicans voted for it. But some hypocritical hangers-on have tried to claim credit for it anyway, like Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker, who infamously bragged that independent restaurant owners would get cash, conveniently omitting the whole I voted against it part. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has a great way of describing these Republicans. They vote no and take the dough. Which brings us to Madison Cawthorn, the youngest member of Congress and reigning teen beat model for owning the libs. Like his baby Trump twinsie in the House, the aforementioned Matt Gaetz, Cawthorn is nothing more than a member of the grand troll party. He told his colleagues in an email, quote, I have built my staff around communications rather than legislation. See, when the House was preparing to vote on the $1.9 trillion stimulus, Madison was, shall we say, busy. That same day, BuzzFeed detailed numerous allegations of sexual misconduct and harassment against Cawthorn while he was in college, which was literally only 4 years ago. Claims that he has denied. But that night, he went on Fox News to crow about outreach to young conservatives.
We're going to make sure we have a great moral foundation to stand upon, and we're going to use all of that to create an incredible economy and an incredible country.
But young Madison wasn't in Washington then. Just hours before the stimulus vote. No. He was in Florida for the CPAC political conference. Like Matt Gaetz, Cawthorn prioritized CPAC over his constituents, voting by proxy instead. Oh, the same dude who has a candidate called Democrats cowards for voting by proxy, which they did because of COVID. Anyway, the hits kept coming for poor little Cawthorn, who had visiting Hitler's vacation home on his little bucket list. Around the same time, the Washington Post detailed some of the false and embellished claims that propelled Cawthorn to the top of the Trumpy troll totem pole, including details about the accident that left him partially paralyzed. He's claimed in speeches that the friend driving him fled and left him for dead. But in a deposition in an insurance case, he did not say his friend left him to die, but rather that he had no memory. But anyway, back to the stimulus. After it passed, Madison proudly tweeted that he voted no for the Pelosi payoff. So naturally, the internet said a good cause to this you, Madison Cawthorn, when he proclaimed yesterday that he was happy to see millions of dollars in federal funds going to medical facilities in North Carolina from the bill he phoned a friend to vote against. Those grants came directly from the Democrats' American Rescue Plan, which begs the obvious question. If it makes you so happy, shouldn't you have voted for it, Q-Bro? Oh, right. Communications, not legislation. Hypocrisy, thy name is Madison Cawthorn, and for that, you earned the dishonor of being crowned the absolute worst. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is proud as a peach of his handling of the coronavirus. After ginning up plaudits from Fox News and Politico, the emboldened king of COVID is targeting private businesses that want their customers to provide proof of vaccination. The cruise industry, which is itching to set sail, has announced vaccination requirements for their guests. DeSantis, ostensibly a free market Republican, has vowed to prohibit private businesses from doing just that, warning he would issue an executive order banning vaccine requirements. He's also vowing to sue the CDC if they don't allow cruises to restart by the summer. The guy is restricting safety requirements while pushing for the industry's top right to pack hundreds of potentially infectious people in confined spaces. Brilliant. Currently, COVID is surging in Florida. Just look at this Mayo Clinic map, which shows the state's hotspots. According to the New York Times, Miami-Dade County, home to spring break destination Miami Beach, is currently a very high-risk zone because of a severe outbreak. In just the last week, the number of variant cases have doubled. The overall number of cases is averaging 5,000 per day. Since the start of the pandemic, nearly 34,000 Floridians have died. Joining me now is Nikki Fried, Florida Commissioner for Agriculture and Consumer Services. And Commissioner Fried, what a strange governor you have. That, you know, I am no longer a Florida resident, so I can say that you have. He wants to sign an executive order. Does he have the power to stop private businesses from requiring people to have a COVID test to, like, get on a cruise? Because that seems beyond the power of a governor. Is that in his power?
You know, he continues to try to expand his power every single day. And I just want to apologize to the rest of the country of what happens here in the state of Florida. I mean, he went off on this rampage earlier this week that he is going to shut down allowing local businesses and state businesses to mandate people from protecting their employees and people that are coming into their, you know, shops or on the cruise line industry. You know, the Republicans continue to be hypocrites. You know, they keep talking about this free market and supporting the Constitution, and that's what their, you know, bread and butter is. But yet every opportunity that Ron DeSantis has, he continues to stifle the economy and stifle these free market businesses who want to just do right by the people and the people that are coming to enjoy their products or, you know, their cruise line industry.
Well, I mean, you know, nothing terrifies me than the idea of being on a cruise ship right now. I mean, COVID and the variants are still raging. They're raging, particularly in Florida, more deaths, more people getting sick. What is the rationale that's coming out of the governor's office to demand that the CDC allow these ships to sail, especially if he's saying he wants them to sail without any kind of vaccine mandates? In other words, he's saying let them sail with sick people and infectious people on them.
Well, let's be realistic. You know, the governor has not been rational from day one. You know, he has taken this very dogmatic approach to the pandemic, open up the state of Florida, never closed it down at the front end, never mandate a mask ordinance, then tells our local governments to take ownership of this issue, and then comes in and says, never mind, we're not going to allow you to enforce your mandates, and we're going to get rid of all of your fines and fees that you've put on the state of Florida and to the people. You know, so he's taken this approach that he just believes that he's right, and he's going to say these things because he's so focused on his popularity and that he wants to take and have ownership of this Trump, you know, lane that we saw in, you know, the last 8 years. And he doesn't really understand that in order for our economy to bounce back, we got to get in front of this pandemic. That means that he should be showing leadership on getting the vaccine, encouraging our businesses and our local communities to be doing right, to make sure that we're wearing masks, we are social distancing, that we are getting everybody vaccinated. Instead, he's focusing on this, you know, dogmatic approach of just open up the economy and we're going to be fine and this herd immunity and we're going to be behind this. And I'm going to go on to these national stages and Fox News and say, you know, victory accomplished. polished and look at everybody. I was right the whole time. He's very egotistical and believes that he's right. Instead of talking about the 34,000 Floridians that we have lost, where's his compassion for those individuals and those family members, businesses that have gone out of business because he refused to put the pandemic and the response to the pandemic as a priority? Instead, he was trying to kiss up to Donald Trump. And even now that he's living in our state, trying to get the support of the past president and all of his supporters, and not recognizing that he's got to focus on the citizens of our state and making sure that we get through this pandemic.
Are you worried that at a certain point, businesses and travelers are going to start to see Florida as sort of an infection hub that doesn't care about, decreasing infections and start to stay away, and that it could end up hurting the economy there?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have friends all across the country who said, listen, I wanted to be down there to see my family during the holidays, and I can't now because you have a governor who's opened up our state. I mean, look what is happening in Miami-Dade County, which is my hometown. You know, I'm somebody who, you know, of course, I appreciate people wanting to, you know, be on spring break and haven't seen their family and haven't seen their friends and have been locked up. But if you don't have a governor who is telling people, yes, come to our state, but you got to be safe. You got to make sure that you're social distancing. You got to be wearing your mask. And eventually people are going to stop coming to the state of Florida because of this. Even if we're all open, if we're not taking the precautions, people are going to not come here to the state.
Let me ask you a question. Are you going to run against him for when he runs for re-election?
You know, Joy, as our only statewide elected Democrat, I am asked this question on an everyday basis. And every single day is becoming clearer and clearer that Ron DeSantis needs to be a one-term governor. Not only has he already left the state of Florida, his eyes are already on 2024, focusing on the presidential bid and not on what's right for the state of Florida. We are getting very close to making a decision because the state of Florida and the people that live here deserve so much better than what they are getting from Ron DeSantis.
Last question. You've accused, there's been some reporting that has accused, and you have also retweeted that the governor there fudged some numbers in terms of COVID. Do you stand by that? There's been some dispute about whether that is true.
Without a doubt. He has been, you know, fudging numbers from day one, both on numbers that were coming out of our nursing homes, coming out of our prison system, asked the different morgues to change the death certificates. And now the latest reports of this week shows that, in fact, we had almost 5,000 more deaths than were reported. So I do believe that he has lost the faith of the citizens of our state because they know that he has not been honest with them from day one.
And Nikki Fried, thank you so much for being here. If you run, please come back and let us know. Appreciate it. That is tonight's readout. All In with Chris Hayes starts now.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.